Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert started cross-examining a U.S. businessman who testified that he gave Olmert $150,000 in cash when Olmert was Jerusalem's mayor. Both the businessman, Moshe Talansky, and Olmert have denied that bribery or other wrongdoing occurred. Olmert has said he will resign if he is indicted. Pope Benedict says insatiable consumption by humans is resulting in a squandering of the world's natural resources. Speaking in Sydney, Australia, the Pope also criticized TV and the Internet, saying they exalt violence and sexual exploitation in the name of entertainment. Benedict spoke to hundreds of thousands of pilgrims gathered for the Church's World Youth Day. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chevy. 8 models with 30 mpg on the highway, including Cobalt XFE Coupe with 36, based on EPA estimates. Chevy.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois, hosting a lifelong learning program developed specifically for adults over 50. Additional information on programs available at 244-9141.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be going to the Focus archives for a program we first broadcast earlier this spring. So that means in this first hour, we'll not take calls. A reminder, though, we will be back live here in hour number two, talking with Eliza Marcus, the author of the book Blood and Belief. It's a history of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. But in this first hour, a conversation with Aram Rawston, the author of the biography The Man Who Pushed America into War. It's about the Iraqi resistance leader Ahmed Chalabi. This is a program we first broadcast in March. And as you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. There are few individuals that had as much to do with the decision of the United States to invade Iraq as Ahmed Chalabi. Our guest for this hour, investigative journalist Aram Rawston, says that Chalabi touched America in three ways. He was able to affirm for a generation of thinkers the urgent need to overthrow Saddam. He fed intelligence and sources to both journalists and the U.S. intelligence services. And he used his personal magnetism, lobbying skills, and tactical abilities to merge U.S. policy with his own ambitions. Is this man that we're talking about, as some say, a brilliant con man, or is he, as others would suggest, a persecuted genius? In this hour of Focus, we'll talk more about the life of Ahmed Chalabi with Aram Rawston. He is the author of a new biography that's titled The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Extraordinary Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmed Chalabi. And it's published by Nation Books, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. A little about our guest. Aram Rawston is an Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter. He's worked as producer at the NBC Nightly News Investigative Unit. He's also been a correspondent for CNN, and he's also been a police reporter in New York City. He specializes in covering national security and law enforcement, as well as other issues. He's reported from around the world, including Iraq, Iran, Liberia, and Colombia. His work has been published in Maclean's, The Nation, The London Observer, GQ Magazine, Mother Jones, and The Washington Monthly. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. We just ask that people who are calling in will try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving. But anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here you'd like to join in the conversation, you can give us a call. Mr. Rawston, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm delighted to appreciate it.
Certainly there were a number of people, I guess you'd have to say a relatively small number of people, who were very important in making the decision to go to war in Iraq. A lot of them, obviously, government officials, president, vice president, secretary of defense, all of the people that advise them. But if you look at this list of people, where would you place this man, Mr. Chalabi, on this list?
Chalabi influenced a lot of people who then influenced other people. So he's way up there. Now, he obviously didn't make any decisions, couldn't make any decisions. He's not an American. He has no position of any authority. But he influenced people who did make decisions and who influenced others, as I say. So I put him up there. I think a lot of people on both sides of the debate, people who view the war as a good thing, and there are those, And people who view the war as a problem, and we know there's plenty of those, view his role as central.
If you ask this question, his long-standing belief that the thing to do was to get rid of Saddam Hussein, was this mostly motivated by a sense of patriotism? That is, he thought truly that it would be better for Iraq if Saddam Hussein was gone, or was this more for personal reasons that were related to his potential for advancement and perhaps his desire to play some kind of role in the government of a new Iraq?
Motive is such a hard thing, obviously. But I think one can't condemn his motives necessarily. He, like so many others, did see that Saddam was a sadistic ruler who really repressed people there. It was an awful sort of Stalinesque dictatorship at times. On the other hand, Chalabi was also motivated by he had been a banker. He was away from his own homeland. He wanted to return to it. He wanted a purpose. It was a very complex set of motivations, like it always is. And especially for somebody who's so active, is it vanity? Is it what is it that drives people to do this sort of thing? Who knows? But he was sometimes single-minded in his hatred of Saddam Hussein and his efforts to do no matter what he could to get him toppled.
Just one other kind of general question, and then I'm sure we'll have calls and we'll get into some more specifics. But how was it that he was able to persuade so many people? And we're talking about, again, people in government and people who advise people in government, and also political commentators and political journalists. How was it that he was able to persuade so many people of the rightness of his cause?
That's one of the things that I hope I conveyed in the book. I spoke to so many people who knew him so well from childhood on, and they all refer to his immense charisma, this ability he had to play up to, and it was a charisma that worked very well one-on-one, to play to people's vanities, to play to people's needs, and to just make these very, very loyal friends who supported him no matter what, who tried to make sure that he was receiving U.S. government funding for his work, who tried to make sure that that obstacles were overcome, and who tried to make sure that he was heard in Washington, D.C., where his message was pushed the most. So a lot of it was just personal. He didn't write a lot. He didn't leave a large, he wrote a couple of op-eds here and there. He gave speeches sometimes, but he didn't leave a body of philosophy, political philosophy and this sort of thing. It was really these sort of personal one-to-one friendships and alliances he built. And then the other remarkable part of his skill was dividing his enemies, so to speak, creating alliances, bringing certain parties together to work against others. He was a master politician in that way.
Clearly, this is an unauthorized biography. Have you met Ahmad Chalabi?
I haven't. I was at one press conference with him in Iraq in 2004, but I was always and he wouldn't participate in this book. I mean, he knew very well that I was doing the book, mm-hmm. and his advisors, they weren't fond of some of the stories, I guess, that I'd done before about him. I think we've always been fair. I've always been fair and accurate and done some good stories on him. But he chose not to participate. But people who did participate included his family. I mean, family members, not all of them, of course, but some friends of his from childhood and the rest of it. I think I was able to build up a really incredible portrait of the man.
Well, again, our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is investigative journalist Aram Rostan. His book is The Man Who Pushed America to War. It's a biography of Ahmad Chalabi. Questions are welcome, and we have somebody here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller here is in Moline on our toll free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning. This is interesting. I don't know. I could be an armchair quarterback, so to speak, or an armchair, figuring out what's going on with this Iraq war. I personally went with George Bush because he seemed to be getting the information supposedly that was correct. And it, I think there's a lot of hatred in that area, in the Middle East, that they'll do anything. They'll lie, cheat, steal, whatever, to try and get somebody to do their dirty work for them. And I think that's what happened. I think we got, went in, did the dirty work. And I don't think we went in there after terrorists as much as I think there was other issues there. Like, for instance, Halliburton. I'm starting to begin to believe that it was all about oil and not about terrorists. Because if had we done that, we'd either gone to straight into Afghanistan and then maybe into Saudi Arabia. But my concern is, did you get any of this backlash? Did you hear people? Have you heard these conspiracy theories out there, so to speak, that we went in there for oil and they give Halliburton these big contracts, or is it just a conspiracy theory?
I don't really think. I mean, oil was certainly a component because oil exists in Iraq. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think, and I think people knew that it did exist. But what something else you mentioned, I thought was interesting. Were you saying people try to get other people to do their dirty work for them? One thing that Chalabi has said, he's sort of bragged about getting the U.S. to topple Saddam for them, for the Iraqis, and there, he said, you know, he claimed that he liberated Iraq by basically enticing the U.S. to invade and topple Saddam Hussein. That he's himself claims credit for. In terms of Halliburton, you know, I really don't know. They certainly, you know, I don't find that particularly credible, but certainly they did a lot of work afterwards.
Hmm. Well, let me ask this question. Obviously, he had this goal to see Hussein toppled, and that happened. But then if you ask the question for him personally, or perhaps other people who were important leaders in the Iraqi National Congress, this was a group that he was involved in, and the INC was certainly very much involved in trying to make the case to the United States for war. For him and for other people like him, did they benefit personally in important ways? I suppose one way would be, well, could you say that they were more wealthy or more powerful after than before?
Well, yeah, and to the degree that before the war, before the invasion, these were exiles who struggled and tried to bring attention to their cause. They were lobbyists, you know, politicians. And when you say they, the Iraqi National Congress largely was his political vehicle. Mm-hmm. At least that's the case I make in the book, and I think it's the case. It was an attempt to be inclusive. Some people said it was inclusive, an umbrella organization, but it largely did what he wanted it to do. It largely pushed his particular agenda, for better or worse. And in terms of he and others, certainly he went to Iraq, returned to Iraq, and did quite well in Iraq. He was rich before that. He sort of lived very well in London when he lived in London. He lived very well in the United States when he was in Washington D.C. He traveled well, and so he certainly lived well. But when he returned to Iraq, he was able to achieve a certain stature. He was in Iraq, and he sort of, for a while there at least, he appeared to be a leader of Iraqis.
Ultimately, though, isn't it the case that if you ask most Iraqis what they think about him, their opinion of him is not particularly high, and perhaps not of anyone, in fact, who was associated with the INC?
No, he's very unpopular there. There's some people who like him. Some of the leaders, the Shiite leaders, like him a lot. But he's very unpopular. And that was proven in this one election they had in 2005. There was an election, and he ran on his own platform with a couple of other candidates. It was parliamentary elections, and he won less than 1% of the vote, just minuscule amounts. I mean, a statistically insignificant number of voters voted for him. So this sort of corroborates what everybody knew, which is that he didn't have any credibility in the street, and yet he had the ability to deal with those who did have credibility in the street. If that makes sense.
Was there, do you think, a time when he seriously thought that he might go back to Iraq and be president or prime minister?
Oh, yeah, that's what. And his followers here, his supporters here, when I use the word followers, I mean these supporters he had, these friendships he built ideologically and just through personal connections that he built amongst Americans, sometimes very powerful Americans. They wanted that. They really believed that, you know, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I started focusing on him. I realized early on in 2002 and then 2003, as I was talking to some people in Washington, that their plan for Iraq really was Chalabi. They sometimes admitted it, sometimes they didn't admit it, but they sometimes that was, I mean, they, you know, they would just say that's the plan. That was the plan. Putting Chalabi would take over control, and that's what it was. So that certainly was what he envisioned and what they envisioned. And certainly some of, and all his followers, at his Iraqi followers, the few he had, they saw him as the next Iraqi, the future leader of Iraq is something they would say sometimes, the future leader of Iraq.
I want to thank the last caller. Go on to someone. This is here in Champaign County where we are. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. A lot of, I heard an interview earlier. I hope you have a great and successful book tour. You mentioned that one of his fortes was, you know, introducing stories and lining up journalists. You said that Judith Miller wouldn't cooperate because he wouldn't cooperate. I wonder whether Michael Gordon, who was featured at great length through the Bush's War documentary on PBS, he was a collaborator with Miller on a lot of the worst stories from the New York Times that they had to apologize for. Did he cooperate with you? And did
I didn't even reach out to Michael Gordon, so I wouldn't say, I can't say whether he would have. But a number of people did cooperate from the New York Times, and certainly Chalabi's closest ally there was Judith Miller.
Right.
And that doesn't seem disputable. And then there were. And I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt your question.
Well, no. That's. I'd like to have a colloquy if we could. But
I was going to say that in other there were other journalists who grew equally close in friendship, where sort of the relationship seemed to exceed the normal relationship one might have with a source, where it seems like a friendship and almost an alliance. And there were some other journalists like that. The one I thought was perhaps the most significant was a guy named David Rose, who you may have heard of, who wrote for Vanity Fair and the London Observer, and whose stories he got real access from Chalabi, real exclusives, but and they had tremendous impact. He would compete with, say, Judith Miller, but also work on stories that were very, very similar. And
he was somebody who's trying to redeem himself now. He feels totally taken, I suppose. But I wonder, what I was getting at is that the CIA is known for its elaborate media campaigns. And I'm wondering, you know, people say the CIA paid him and established the Iraqi National Congress. But I wonder how much of the writing of these press releases and stuff actually came out of the Iraqi National Congress and the head of Chalabi, and how much was, you know, sort of a co-production with Douglas Feith, perhaps, and things like that. There's a contemporary thing as a political fixer in Iraq, I believe. Well, why don't I let you respond to that first, if I could. The idea that how much were they playing each other, and the U.S. needed some kind of spokesperson and figurehead to expect to be the president.
I hate to make it even more complicated, but of course Chalabi had, you know, the whole Chalabi story underlines the reality of America's government, that it can be so fractured. And you pointed to Douglas Feith and his office at the Pentagon, but the CIA at the time simply wasn't working with Chalabi anymore. They used to in the early 90s. When he first started doing sort of propaganda and media operations and so forth, but it wasn't, sort of, no one was moving towards a U.S. invasion back then. But they basically found him to be a liability and a problem, and so they cut him off in 96 and 97. So the time I'm referring to and you're referring to here would be sort of post, you know, during the Bush administration, post 9/11, post the 9/11 attacks, when sort of the Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress really came to their, I can say, their glory. That's when they really started achieving what they were looking for. And their money was flowing into them through the State Department. It was basically, sometimes unwillingly from the State Department, but Congress was encouraging the State Department to pay money to them, and they were very active.
The Feith organization was developed just because of what you point out, that the CIA wasn't playing anymore. I think you go into the story that The CIA was ready to dump him, but the Congress actually intervened and insisted that the State Department continue his support, and this was around the time of the Iraqi Regime Change Act in the middle of the Carter time. I thank for your colloquy here, and David, but one thing I'd like to point out is that I remember distinctly that his role as a political fixture in occupation Iraq included him being hobnobbing with the current enemy du jour, Sadr. And Sadr was paid like something like $320 million right around that same time, and I'm wondering whether that was part of the political fix that Chalabi engineered at the time. If you know anything on that, I'd appreciate it, and I'll hang up and see what happens next. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. After the war, after the invasion, Chalabi stepped in, and his, as we've seen with him time and time again, he'll make alliances, and then they'll shatter. And here he had an alliance, obviously, with the U.S. government early on in the war, but then that gave way because he was basically an obstacle to everything they tried to do. Anything that the head of the occupation tried, Paul Bremer was trying, Chalabi basically tried to prevent. He really put himself in as a spoiler, you could say, and he was looking to gain political traction in Iraq. As we talked about, he didn't have a street. He didn't have a street following. He didn't have a constituency, so he was looking for one. And one of the places he turned was, he grew closer to Iran. Everybody close to him says his ties to Iran and to the Shiite causes really became much more firm. He'd always been very sort of strong in support of his Shiite heritage, and sort of that was one of his motivations, people say. But it was after the invasion that became really clear. He began to wear it on his sleeve much more. And he began to ally himself with Muqtada al-Sadr. That alliance really solidified after his sort of break with the U.S. occupation forces, with Bremer. He turned to whoever would have him, and one of the people who would have him was Muqtada al-Sadr, who was sort of battling it out with the United States at the time very fiercely. And Chalabi allied himself very strongly, as much as he could with him. He advised him. He's almost a strategist. He tried to groom him. In the ways of sort of the political wiles that Chalabi was so good at.
Altogether, how much money did the United States give to the Iraqi National Congress?
My estimate, and this includes, and obviously a lot of this money was covert funding, so you don't really, can't really tally it up, but my estimate was that from 92, when the CIA started covertly funding him, until 2003, when basically his funding was mainly from the State Department and then the Defense Intelligence Agency, was $59 million in U.S. taxpayer funds went directly to the Iraqi National Congress, or even indirectly, but for the Iraqi National Congress. There was other funding that helped benefit Chalabi's cause, but that's what I think, that's the estimate that I came up with.
$59 million. And were you able to, or was anybody able to establish exactly what that money went for, right, and
no.
Where it went?
No. That, I mean, money and Chalabi is the other big issue, I've thought. Certainly I was able to track some of it. Some of it went to lining up these, paying for the expenses of these, quote, defectors and sources that the Iraqi National Congress was producing, but very little of it. It was not a lot of money. Those guys didn't cost a lot of money. It was hotel rooms here, or airplane there, meals, pocket money to keep them around in the Middle East or maybe in Asia sometimes. But they weren't, they didn't eat up those millions of dollars. A lot of it went to organizing. A lot of it went to, or just organizing this Iraqi National Congress, keeping it, in copiers, keeping the people flying around and communications and all that. Some of it went to little sort of operations they tried. Some of it went to their, early in the 90s, they tried some sabotage. They tried running, quote, little operations against Saddam. Nothing big, nothing really successful. And they even tried their little, forming little armies. But that's, the accounting was always a problem, always a major problem. A lot of it went to a newspaper, sort of propaganda that they were supposed to be broadcasting into Iraq, sort of counter Saddam propaganda into Iraq and running the newspaper. There's no evidence it really did it, had much of an impact.
We're about midway through here. Let me introduce again our guest, Aram Rostin. He's an award-winning, Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter. He's worked as a producer at the NBC Nightly News Investigative Unit. He's also been a correspondent for CNN and has worked as a police reporter in New York City. He's reported from around the world, many places, including Iraq, Iran, Liberia, Colombia. His work has been published in several places, Maclean's, The Nation, The London Observer, Washington Monthly. He's the author of a new biography of Ahmad Shalabi. The title of the book is The Man Who Pushed America to War. It's published by Nation Books. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, if you want to give us a call. I want to ask you about another kind of financial subject, and this is the story of the Petra Bank, which he started in the late 70s in Jordan, and then about 10 years later ended up having to leave the country and, in fact, was convicted and sentenced in absentia for bank fraud by the Jordanians. And if he would ever go back in Jordan again, the idea is that they could pick him up and they could throw him in jail. And he, of course, claimed that he didn't do anything wrong. What's the story of Shalabi and Petra Bank?
If you like a good story about financial fraud and shenanigans and sort of these epic white-collar empires, this is a good one. It's a really weird story. The Chalabi's bank, Petra Bank, was part of the Chalabi family banking empire, as I saw it, as his family members explained it, and those who were close to him explained it. I think it's important to look at that past because of all that money that he received from the U.S. government. So clearly, if he has issues with the way he handles money, then it raises doubts about why the U.S. government was funding him to such a great extent. And he always claimed, you know, he was framed. Of course, most people say they're framed when they're accused of crimes, but he seems to have gotten away with that explanation. He said that his bank was running just fine. His bank in Petra Bank was running just fine. He said it was very successful, but he always told everyone, there was a conspiracy against him by Saddam Hussein, who was, of course, across the border from Jordan, but who was influential in Jordan. And he says Saddam Hussein was basically framed him, used the Jordanians to frame him and take over his bank, shut down his bank. And then he claims that if he hadn't fled from Jordan and escaped when he was being investigated, that he would have been handed over to Saddam Hussein's secret police, and then they would have taken him across the border into Iraq and executed him. That's his claim. Anything's possible, of course. One can never disprove some sort of frame job like that. But it seemed very unlikely, and there were major financial irregularities and crimes and problems with Petrobank. And what's even more significant is he does claim that Petrobank, his bank, was a well-run organization. The reality is Petrobank was part of a network of Chalabi family banks around the world. They had one. They had a couple in Switzerland. They had a couple they had one in Lebanon. They even had a bank in the Sudan, believe it or not. And they had a branch of the bank in Washington, and they had of Petrobank in Washington. And there was some Chalabi operations in London too. And what happened? The chronology was this. In reality, the first Chalabi family bank to go was in Switzerland. In April of 1989, the Swiss authorities took it over because of problems. The Swiss banking authorities, they took over that bank. Following that, there was a series of problems, problems that this network of banks was exposed. And then Petrobank was taken over after the Jordanian authorities discovered major problems in its books. Then the bank in Lebanon collapsed and was taken over, and so on and so forth. There was this huge unregulated bank they ran in Switzerland. Many of the clients, the depositors, would have been out, you know, all their savings, had not the government of Jordan stepped in. In some places, in one of the Chalabi family operations in Switzerland, people who were, they're called clients really rather than depositors because it acted like a bank, but it wasn't a bank. All these people went bust. They lost everything. And it's elaborate. There were elaborate frauds and people, just a colorful cast of characters who were involved in the Chalabi family empire. Just an American who was more recently convicted of a crime, fraud here in, wire fraud here in the United States. He was a disbarred attorney who once tried to buy this Nevada brothel and then later on showed up working with Ahmad Chalabi's group. And Maybe that's too much detail.
Well, that's a pretty good story in and of itself, just that chapter of this guy's life.
It's a hell of a story.
Just I'm curious that he has this interesting background in the sense that yes, they're the family has this business empire. He personally, at least for part of his life, was a mathematician. In fact, he has a PhD in math from the University of Chicago and also taught math at American University in Beirut. I'm interested in how it is he pursued this academic career in mathematics, but then turned around and got involved in this in business and then in politics, and perhaps at least the business and the politics are tangled up together and always have been. Maybe that those things have always been part of his life. Was there ever any time when he really was thinking about leading the quiet life of an academic mathematician?
He was he's an immensely complicated person. But one of his professors is the closest professor to him in Lebanon, a guy named Azmi Hanna, wonderful mathematics professor, really was fond of him and thought he was just a wonderful math professor and thought he was very dedicated to mathematics. And he, you know, Chalabi worked, he was very diligent. He worked even, you know, at a certain point at the American University of Beirut, where they taught, it was virtually shut down because of the war, the civil war in Lebanon. But Chalabi and some of his colleagues continued to teach. They weren't getting paid. They continued to teach. They cared so much about academia. But on the other hand, yeah, there was this other side to him that apparently was always there. But more to the point, some people believe he really would have been happy if he'd stayed as a professor, as he was as a young man. But the family pushed him to be a banker. That was the calling. That was a family business, really, you know. So, and according to some of them, there was always that pressure to be a banker. And I guess it's sort of one of these stories that one has, these universal stories of the family pressuring the young man to do something that he doesn't necessarily want to do.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the making the case, his role and the role of the Iraqi National Congress, which you said it sort of is him anyway, that essentially was his group, mm-hmm. that the role that they played in making the case for the invasion, and specifically in the kind of information, maybe you could talk about the kind of information that they provided, information that I think a lot of people were casting doubt on right from the start, that information that ultimately was then used by the Bush administration to say, yes, we believe that Saddam Hussein has these weapons of mass destruction, and this is a really serious issue, and that's why we need to go in and do this. What sort of information did Chalabi and the INC provide to the U.S. government?
It's a complex issue because, the U.S. government was so fractured. Chalabi and his people tried very much to provide agencies of the U.S. government with information about weapons of mass destruction and about alleged links by Saddam Hussein to terror and even 9/11. The problem is, most people in the U.S. government really were very wary, very leery about Chalabi and his group. They weren't likely to believe it. There were some who would believe it, and we're all familiar by now, I think, with some of the so-called neoconservatives and their ties to Chalabi. But somehow, they did manage to insert this information into the U.S. media, as I sort of tried to document by talking to Chalabi's, former officials, or the people who worked with him, who now are not necessarily close to him anymore, and who have that inside story. They also have the story of how they tried to insert it into the U.S. intelligence stream. There they got a lot more resistance. It was very tough for them to do. Nonetheless, a lot of the information, the CIA almost tried to weed out some of Chalabi's information. But nonetheless, it ended up in various ways in the U.S. administration's case for war, such as, for example, Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations. Some of the characters, who Chalabi, well, at least one of the characters Chalabi's people had introduced to the Western media and Western intelligence, showed up in Powell's speech as corroboration for this sort of, biological weapons labs that was such a big issue in the war. So that was the type of information. Number one, it was, and I'll give you the four cases that I think were the most compelling, if you have time for them.
Sure.
Well, the one immediately after 9/11, and that's when Chalabi's, really snow began to stick, really the most. After 9/11, America was ready to hear the message. One was this idea that Saddam Hussein had trained these hijackers, that had just training camp for hijackers in Iraq. This idea that Iraqis and Islamists could have been trained to take over planes in Iraq in a camp that was sanctioned by Saddam Hussein. It was a scary thought if it's true, because, well, you know, then you end up with this immediate issue. It's an immediate danger, you know, if it's the case. That's one story, and that was not the case. Of course, it was false. Another story was weapons of mass destruction, where they found somebody who alleged he saw these. He was helping hide weapons deep underground, right in the middle of Baghdad. That was a case that Judy Miller wrote up. Then there was another case of a guy who claimed he'd actually invented the concept of these mobile biological labs. He was in Jordan. He was introduced by the Chalabi people to the Defense Intelligence Agency and to lots of journalists. And then there was a case that is less known. It's called, I call it, Saddam's Mistress. It's about a woman who had some sort of relationship with Saddam Hussein, but later claimed that she could testify about Saddam Hussein's alleged links to, personal links to, Osama bin Laden. There, nobody thinks she was telling the truth, but it was a story that got out there. All those stories found their way somehow into the intelligence stream. Most were discarded, but they did find their way into it. That's the sort of information that was most crucial in terms of what they provided. Now, they also did provide more. There was a whole stream of defectors with minor stories, right? But most of it, people were never impressed by the intelligence information that was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
If I can add to that, there was one other issue where, to give them their due, the human rights abuses by Saddam Hussein's administration were tremendous, and sort of his... So that issue, I think they were a little more reliable on. Now, you know, the oppression by Saddam Hussein, the murders and so forth, there I think Chalabi's people were sometimes more accurate than on anything else.
If we could sit down with Mr. Chalabi today and we could say to him, look, you said all of these things, you provided to the U.S. government this information that Hussein had a training camp for hijackers and that there were weapons of mass destruction, and you had this guy who said, yeah, I can tell you all about these mobile chemical weapons labs, and I can introduce you to a woman who was Saddam's mistress and says that he had personal ties to Osama bin Laden, all that sort of stuff. And in addition to are saying, and you also encouraged the United States government to believe that the U.S. forces would be greeted as liberators, mm-hmm. and that the people would say, thank you very much, great job, Saddam Hussein was a terrible guy, you got rid of him for us, and we'll take it from here, and that they would then pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and he and others would create this new Iraq. If we said to him, look, you told us all that, and none of it has turned out to be true, what do you think he would say?
Oh, well, he's actually said it too. It's a good point. I mean, I tried to spell out his reaction in the book, because the story's changed. First, he stood by all these defectors, and then later it changed. But they say their current the story is, you know, they never vouched for these defectors and all this intelligence. They were just passing it on. It's not their job to vet it. It's the intelligence agency's job to vet it. It's the journalists. They're just passing on a tip. It was their argument. Now, to journalists who heard this, that was outrageous, because they thought these people were vouching for everybody and saying that was what they were saying. So, but that's their immediate reaction.
Let's talk with someone else. In Urbana, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hello. What amazes me is, why did anyone ever believe these stories? Hussein and bin Laden had a long history of animosity. They were enemies. Why would anyone believe that Saddam would help him? He'd be afraid that he'd use those weapons and techniques against Hussein. The story about the chemical weapons, mobile laboratories, is so improbable. This is a science that demands absolute cleanliness. How would you maintain it in a truck? All of these stories were so outlandish. Would you comment?
No, you're right. I mean, there were many claims that were made. And the heart of the claim, I think, was the most complex one. here you've got to the details of some of these assertions, but what about the one of the main claims was sort of this general tendency to believe what Chalabi was selling, which was that once you topple Saddam Hussein, this sort of wonderful society would spring out of Iraq. Stability, peace, and democracy, and then that in turn would be emulated by other nations around in that region, and it would sort of be this domino effect of peace and prosperity and democracy. That was the big claim, perhaps, right? I think if people believe that. And how people would believe that is another issue that experts in the region are just don't understand. But that was one of their big claims. And then each one of the ones you pointed out, of course, yeah, it's empirically people, intelligence agencies knew Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden had publicly opposed Hussein. He'd publicly went on television and denounced him too. So
well, he offered his help in overthrowing him in what was it, 91, the first war?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, in 80, yeah, when during the first after they invaded Kuwait, after Saddam invaded Kuwait, he offered to help defend Saddam defend Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So yeah, so you're right. These there's a sort of a level of credibility that was of sort of skepticism that was suspended for a while here in the United States.
Well,
and that I think is credited to, in parts. You know, maybe you can blame journalists. Maybe you can blame the administration. But I don't know. You can also say Chalabi also was a very convincing person, and his supporters were very convincing.
Well, I can understand the American public because it is so historically illiterate and so lacking in any knowledge of the Middle East. But you would think that papers like the New York Times, at least the editors, would have some critical faculty. But,
you know, it's interesting there. Just as I think you could point to the fractured U.S. government, point to the fractured New York Times, administration. People there were some people were very, very skeptical about Ahmad Chalabi. They knew him for years too, but yet somehow it seeped into the Times. And the same is true for other news organizations.
I want to jump in here. I want to thank the caller. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left, and I'd like to introduce again the guest for this hour, Aram Rostin. He is an investigative reporter. He's worked as producer at the NBC Nightly News Investigative Unit. He's also been correspondent for CNN. He's the author of a new book about Ahmad Chalabi. The title of his book is The Man Who Pushed America to War. The publisher is Nation Books, and it's out now if you want to take a look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something I want to make sure that we talk about, or that I give you a chance to talk about, is the connections between Chalabi and Iran and the government of Iran.
I'm glad you brought that up. Now, it just all depends on one's perspective, because from the U.S. perspective, that's a real problem, right? But one would think. But from his perspective, you know, he's not an American. And Iran's a neighbor of Iraq. Iran is the place through which he enters and leaves Iraq. He can't go through Jordan, of course, and he can't really go through Saudi Arabia because he's wanted in Jordan, and Jordan has some influence in that region. So he goes through Iran, where he does have freedom of movement, and they treat him well. He also had ties to their intelligence service and their what they call the Revolutionary Guards, which is charged with propagating the Islamic Revolution, which started so long ago under Ayatollah Khomeini. The Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guards is the sort of stormtroops for that effort, to propagate that effort internationally, especially in Iraq. And so I did learn that there was a particular individual, a general, who is a part of the Revolutionary Guards, a guy named Ahmed Frozenda. He is closely watched by American forces because he's believed to be a real problem, a real threat to Americans and American soldiers and American efforts in Iraq and American lives in Iraq. And Chalabi did meet with him before the war, sometime before the war, and he also met with him after the war, which was a matter of immense concern for U.S. intelligence agencies, for some people in the U.S. government. Now, the weird thing, of course, is that Chalabi's American supporters don't care about any of this. They haven't really, doesn't bother them. They feel he has to do it, and they feel he's probably outwitting the Iranians and is more loyal to the Americans than to the Iranians. And So they don't really have an issue with his and they certainly haven't had an issue with his meeting with the Iranians and his relationship with him.
Hmm. Well, there is there, some people have suggested that he might be providing important, significant information, intelligence information to Iran that we might not be happy with having the Iranians have. I mean, is there anything to that?
Well, there was a massive FBI investigation into how the Iranians learned about a cracked code. They believed that Chalabi inadvertently, you know, the thinking was, Chalabi was around a lot of American intelligence officers and might have learned about this fact and relayed it to the Iranians, was the thinking. The problem is they never, the FBI really was never able to interrogate him, never able to question him. They tried. They tried repeatedly. They pulled out all these defense intelligence officers and intelligence officers from Iraq who were based near Chalabi. They just started in bringing them back to the States. They interviewed them. There was a massive investigation. But the key piece they needed, apparently, was to interview Ahmad Chalabi. And that never happened. He agreed to it. They thought they had something agreed to and something almost scheduled. And then he sort of said he was too busy to reschedule. And nothing ever happened. It never worked out. So that investigation was never resolved. Mm.
We have time for some other callers. In fact, we have a couple of people here who are on hold. We'll try to get them both in the time that remains. So the next person up in line is in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Hello. My source is January 2004 Mother Jones feature article on the focus is on the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon and so on, and mentions Chalabi. But did the INC really stand alone, or did it have the support of, well, of course, Neil Khan Hawks did support it, but did it have the support of the Project for New American Century or the American Enterprise Institute? And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Sure. The INC and Chalabi had immense support from these think tanks, neoconservative think tanks and others in Washington, D.C., who believed firmly that Chalabi was a credible individual who was somebody who they should trust. And so you saw, and there was a sort of, I wouldn't say revolving door, but a similarity of people who were in the administration at one point, and some of those think tanks that you've pointed to. And so, yeah, the INC had a lot of support from those think tanks. They were very important for his in how he managed to achieve so much in terms of getting people on his side in Washington, D.C.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, sort of following up on this. What's the story about Chalabi and Paul Wolfowitz going back to University of Chicago? Can you fill any details on that?
You know, they both were there. I wasn't able to confirm that they met each other. I don't think they did. I could be wrong, though. I wasn't able to confirm it.
Yeah,
they certainly there was a nexus, of course, but of a lot of people at the University of Chicago, like Richard Pearl too.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think they met, and I believe they met well after that. They met in 1985. I think they didn't meet back in the University of Chicago days.
Yep.
That's why it could be wrong. They may have met, but it wasn't where these real bonds were forged.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. I'd like to talk about Chalabi today. Now, we did talk earlier about the fact that he might have one time had this ambition of being the leader of the new Iraq, the post-Saddam Hussein Iraq, and maybe some other people in Washington, D.C. thought so, too. He has occupied a couple of posts in the post-invasion government, but hasn't had anything like the kind of political success that he would have liked, or perhaps other people in Washington would like to see him have. What is he doing now?
To a degree, he's back. I mean, he has a lot more influence than he had last year, at a minimum. And he's working with Americans. He's working with Iraqi officials. He's got this portfolio that was handed to him, that he worked for hard, but he was handed to him. It's not officially, it's sort of a quasi-official position. He's been named in charge of, quote, a services committee, it's called. and is basically in charge of reconstruction in Baghdad. Reconstruction like water, sewage, sanitation, electricity, health, hospitals, but which are in such awful shape there. People don't have, drinkable water, and sewage is pumped into the Tigris River, and garbage is sometimes not picked up, and there are these problems. And what's happened is that he being who he is, he's been, in the fall, he stepped into this role again, where he would be the coordinator that would discuss things with all the ministers to work towards solving these problems. He deals with American officials again. And what is remarkable is he's dealing with American officials again in a very, substantive way. It's just less than 2 years after the Senate Intelligence Committee found that his Iraqi National Congress, before the war, had intentionally introduced false information into the intelligence stream to try to impact and affect U.S. foreign policy. But in spite of that, in spite of all of it, he's again working with Americans and with Iraqis in a position of some influence.
That just, to me, seems remarkable given all of the questions about his past and the role that he played in making the case for war and a lot of other things that that the United States would still want to have anything to do with this guy.
Yeah, it's an interesting fact. I mean, and when you look at everything, you look at, the banking, you look at the money that's gone, you look at everything. Iran, the list goes on and on. Muqtada, his ties to Muqtada al-Sadr, to Iran, to everything. Let alone the defectors, the false intelligence. But nonetheless, what they say is, their argument is, well, hey, at least he can get things done, And who knows, maybe that's what they're, at least he seems to get... At least he seems to be able to organize things better than most officials they've dealt with over there.
Hmm. Given now that you have been following politics here in this area for some time, I'm wondering if you have some general thoughts about where things stand now and where things are headed, at least in the next couple of years. Certainly, it seems that after a period of less violence, we do seem to be seeing an upswing now and questions about, certainly there are a lot of questions about will there continue to be an American military presence there and for how long and how many, and of course that is going to depend greatly on who the next president of the United States is. Do you have some thoughts about where this country is headed?
Iraq.
Yes, not the United States. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean Iraq.
Sources all tell me that the administration in Iraq, it's very tenuous, and a lot of people want it to go, but they don't want it to go too quickly. The government of Nouri al-Maliki is it's walking a tightrope, and it's been one of the main issues. Even when the common wisdom is that somehow the surge helped at least fight some of the insurgents, and that these other military efforts to work with Sunni fighters was bearing some fruit. But then you've got, that's the common wisdom is, you've got this political stalemate where the government of Nouri al-Maliki, which is largely a Shiite-dominated government, is confronting problems and is unwilling to really negotiate that much. And so you have, that's, according to the common wisdom, is the real block here. You've got corruption. You've got immense sort of militias, sort of each militia, each Islamic party is fighting for its own benefit rather than for the country's benefit. And you have nothing that's going to give. So a lot of people are hoping that there'll be some change in government there.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. Our guest, Aram Rostan, is an Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter. He's worked as producer at NBC Nightly News Investigative Unit. He's also been correspondent for CNN, has reported on Iran, Iraq, Liberia, Colombia. He's the author of the book, The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Extraordinary Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmad Chalabi. It's published by Nation Books. And Mr. Rostan, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast this show March 26th of this year. Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com. We're going to break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Both in Kansas City and at the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's go right to the prices. September wheat in Kansas City, $8.49 down 11.5. December, $8.71.5 down 11.5. September wheat at the Board of Trade, $8.11 down 23. December, $8.33.5 down 23.75. March of 2009, $8.73 down 6.75. September corn, $6.33 down 25.5. December, $6.52 down 25.25. March of 2009, $6.70 down 25.5. May of 2009, $6.98 down 9.